Way down among Brazilians, coffee beans grow by the billions, so they've got to find those extra cups to fill. They've got an awful lot of coffee in Brazil. You can't get cherry soda, 'cause they've got to fill that quota. And the way things are, I'll bet they never will. They've got a zillion tons of coffee in Brazil.
The theory behind making coffee is simple. You just add water to ground coffee, then filter out the grounds. But ever since the creation of this beverage, people have been tinkering with the basic formula. And one of the most long-lasting inventions, one that has profoundly changed the way the world consumes caffeine, is espresso. For this week's Please Explain, we are talking all about espresso with Aaron Meister, a writer and journalist who has spent 14 years in the coffee industry, and Aaron McCarthy, a technician at Counterculture Coffee, who has worked as a barista and trainer for years, and in 2013 was the first American winner of the World Brewers Cup champion. We invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation. You can give us a call at 212-433-9692. Write to us on our show page at WMIC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And I'm very pleased to welcome both of our guests to our show, although this might be a bit confusing with two Aarons as guests. So should I address you by your last names, or should I just, in the case of Aaron Meister, I understand you kind of like being called Meister?
Yeah, most people actually do call me Meister.
So I'll call you Meister and I'll call him Aaron. Is that okay?
Sounds great.
That sounds perfect.
Okay, Meister, where and when was espresso first invented?
Oh, that's a great question. One of my favorite things to talk about, actually. So espresso was invented. Well, the espresso machine obviously invented the beverage of espresso. There was no espresso before the invention of that machine. And it happened around the Industrial Revolution in Italy, so in the late 1800s, the early 1900s, sort of at the peak of steam power being the force that people used for all kinds of technological and industrial innovation, it was basically a way to apply that technology, steam technology, to this coffee making that had been going on for centuries that was more manual and more individualized and more artisanal, and sort of speed up the process, kind of like everything else that was happening during the Industrial Revolution. It basically took a handmade product and mechanized it, so to speak.
Is anyone credited with inventing the first espresso machine? Is there a patent, an original patent?
Yeah, the patent that's recognized generally as the first espresso machine patent was in 1901 from a man named Luigi Bezzera. And it is essentially a giant steam boiler that's just modified to make coffee. also could sort of serve as a... It was actually sort of really dangerous. The first espresso... people who made espresso were actually called maquinistas, or machine operators. They weren't called baristas, because it was really a matter of just operating this hulking steam-powered machine that spit really hot coffee out really fast. It's actually kind of a dangerous job.
Now, Aaron, you are someone who works with those machines. Is it still dangerous?
It's definitely not as dangerous as it used to be.
They don't explode anymore?
They don't generally explode. there are a lot of safety switches and ways along to cut off heat so that it won't overheat and it won't explode. Correct me if I'm wrong, Meister, but it's my understanding that the invention of steaming milk was really just they needed a valve to release some steam as the boiler heated, and they figured, well, why not just start heating a little milk since we're going to add milk to it anyway, and that's kind of like the evolution of the cappuccino as well.
Yeah, that's kind of the origin story, was that, you know, in order to prevent the machine from exploding, you did have to release a little bit of steam periodically, and they also realized, well, we could be using the steam to heat milk and add that to the drink, and it became a sort of, that was kind of the invention of the cappuccino, because the cappuccino also then became a sort of stand-in for breakfast for folks, because it had a little bit more nutrition than just straight espresso on its own, which has no nutritional value at all. I'm sorry to break hearts everywhere.
Is it true that Italians won't drink a cappuccino after noon?
Well, I mean, it tends to be more traditional to have a cappuccino in the morning before noon. I think that there are people everywhere that sort of buck tradition, so I'd hate to tell the Italians what they can and can't do. But yeah, it is definitely considered like a morning beverage. It's sort of breakfast. Cappuccino, like traditional food breakfast, isn't really had. People typically take an espresso or cappuccino in the morning and then move on to food later on.
Well, I have seen Americans given the fishy-eyed stare when they've asked for a cappuccino with dinner. But where does the name come from, cappuccino?
Well, the theory is that it's called a cappuccino after the monks of Capuchin, which was a sect of Franciscan friars, the kind of friars like Friar Tuck, who have a brown cowl and a bald head. And so if you were looking down at them from the top, you would see a white circle surrounded by brown, which is what the design on the cappuccino traditionally sort of is a white dot of foam or froth, and then the brown ring of crema on the outside, just like an aerial view of a monk.
We're talking with Aaron Meister and Aaron McCarthy about cappuccino, espresso, and related coffees on today's Please Explain. This is WMYC, WMYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Aaron, where did latte come from?
Actually, I do think that, I mean, latte just meaning milk, you know, so getting more milk than espresso for your buck. So I think that it basically was invented around the same time as the cappuccino, just having more milk to it.
And then you just whip up the milk?
Absolutely, yeah. You steam it, mm-hmm. With, using the same machine that you heat the coffee water with.
Although at home, you can just put the milk into the microwave and then whip it after you've heated it up for a minute.
You could, yeah. That is one way to create foam.
And what about the Americano? Was that, isn't that just watered down espresso?
It is. I believe that came about during World War II, where Americans in Europe were trying to get that watered-down brewed coffee that Americans loved, and were in, Italy asking for a coffee, and what they got was espresso. So kind of conversations, maybe some loud talking arguments over some time kind of settled on, okay, I think what they want an espresso, but they want it watered down. So it became called Americano because of that.
And can you still find the Americano in Europe, or is it only popular in this country?
It's funny. There are places, I know that the Americano isn't actually a particularly popular beverage in American espresso bars, but it is like the most popular beverage in Korean espresso bars, which is kind of interesting. To think about the ways that espresso culture has bounced around the globe, and every place that it's kind of landed since its invention in Italy, it has picked up all these little different like quirks or idiosyncrasies based on the culture that it lands in, which is kind of funny. But I'm actually drinking an Americano right now. I don't know if that counts for anything.
We're going to take a call from John from Williamsburg. Hi, John. You're on the air. By the way, our number here is 212-433-9692, or you can also write to us on our show page at WMIC.org or on Facebook or Twitter. John, what do you want to talk about?
Hey, Leonard, I had a question for the experts. The movement has been here in the United States particularly to go to single-origin espressos, and I think in the history of espresso, it's really been a mix between Robusto and Arabica beans, and it's always given that heavier cup and much more lasting crema in the cup. And today's espresso that I'm getting in most bars that comes across is very fragile, very sour, and I wonder if that's due to it being a single origin, and if the single origin is really a true espresso in terms of the history of espresso.
Aaron, do you worry about what kind of coffee you're going to use, where the beans come from?
Oh, absolutely.
Whether it's Robusto or Arabica?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing to know is that, espresso being a method of preparation, you can really put any bean from any origin in an espresso grinder, and you can make espresso. Some of them, because of the volatility inside the espresso machine, you know, 130 pounds per square inch of pressure, 200 degrees of water, you're extracting much more efficiently than you would with brew coffee. So that means that some coffees will exhibit more balance than others. And there is definitely a history of using Robusta, especially was for crema, and also for that kind of like rounding out, you know, giving that kind of base note to it. And blends were easier to use for a couple of reasons. One is that you could hide lower quality coffees in a blend. Blends roasted to the point of consistency would mean that there is maybe less nuance and less acidity, but there's definitely more consistency. And also, you know, chocolatey things and nutty things go pretty well with milk. It's definitely also an American tradition as well. When you think about the coffees that are close to us being, you know, Brazilian coffees and Central American, definitely a wildly different flavor profile than coffees from Africa. And so this turn to using single origin, I think, for a couple of reasons, you know, to highlight origin in itself and to remember that coffee is a food.
But getting back to something you just said, you said that that most coffee, the coffee that most of us drink, is just simply water that sits within the ground coffee and then drips out, and whereas espresso is a more efficient thing, it's actually pressured out, so we're getting more of the liquid out, I would assume. There's what's left is a very dry residue instead of that wet residue that you get from a standard coffee maker or from a French press coffee.
Well, the puck is definitely still fully saturated. And you are able to, I think when I say efficient, I meant over time. You know, you can extract in 20 to 30 seconds an espresso, whereas you need 3 to 4 minutes to extract fully for a brewed coffee.
Let's take another call. Liam from Greenpoint. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing? Well, first of all, Aaron, I love the Big Trouble blend that you guys have. It's really amazing coffee. And my question is kind of related to that, too. I was just wondering that it seems like I'm just seeing so many different coffee roasts from different organizations, mostly like a lot of different places in Brooklyn and San Francisco and all across the country. And I was just wondering, where do you really see the marketplace kind of going for that, for boutique or artisanal roasters? Or do you think that there's going to be several that kind of rise to the top and do become somewhat national brand, or if it's going to continue to be served by boutique roasters?
That's a great question. I guess, yeah, both Meister and I could take turns answering that. But I think that we've seen a few of the bigger roasteries that have started small and gotten bigger, you know, have to get outside funding. I think that question kind of, to me, the background of specialty coffee in general, global climate change, how there, you know, is going to be less and less specialty coffee as we go, that's definitely going to influence these smaller roasteries who are kind of doing their thing, buying very small lots, getting by.
Are they like microbreweries for beer?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Concept? Absolutely. Yeah, there are. For instance, I mean, Meister works for a green coffee importer right now, and so she maybe can speak more to
Meister.
Yeah, I'm actually working with, you know, roasters that as small as, you know, they have 25-pound roasters. I have starting conversations with people who are roasting in their garage or roasting in their basement. And I think the really interesting thing is that people are not as afraid of trying coffee roasting and trying to break into the coffee industry. And I think that what makes that so exciting is that people are really looking to serve a very particular community. I feel like there's a lot of opportunity, obviously, for a big roaster to have a really national presence or an international presence and to really establish a brand on a larger scale like that. But there's also so much opportunity for just a small producer to say, like, I would like to just roast some coffee on the weekends and to sell it to my local neighborhood shop or to sell it at a farmer's market. And that's still actually pretty viable. There's a lot of stuff going on in coffee that makes it sometimes very daunting or very difficult from, you know, the perspective of buying high-quality coffees or sourcing high-quality coffees or selling them. But I also think that there's a lot of people just sort of taking the bull by the horns and doing it, doing some really exciting, really special stuff. I think that as specialty coffee in general moves toward this greater awareness of, like, climate change's effect on it and the market's effect on our perception of coffee quality, I think that we have the opportunity to become a little bit more open-minded about who's doing coffee roasting and coffee buying and coffee sourcing and what they're doing, and explore a little bit more of what's possible in the cup based on just being a little bit more open to some different flavors and some different experiences.
Aaron, didn't you take an apprenticeship with a roaster?
I did, yeah. It was while I was working at a roastery out of Ithaca, New York, Gimme Coffee, I did apprentice roast for a year. And
what did
just
you learn?
6 months in. I learned how to not burn coffee, definitely. I definitely witnessed a couple of roaster fires. You know, the biggest thing I learned in learning how to roast was kind of developing my palate at the same time. So being able to, when I was roasting, I really was a production roaster, so I was following recipes. So I really, you know, there wasn't a ton of what I was doing I was kind of like a line cook, if you will, you know? So my development at that point as a coffee person was palate development.
We have to take a little break and we'll come back with more. We invite your calls. Our number is 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter. My handle is at Leonard Lopate. My guests are Aaron McCarthy, a technician at Counterculture Coffee, and also Aaron Meister, a writer and journalist who spent 14 years in the coffee industry. We're talking espresso and related matters. We'll be back right after this.
Black coffee, I'm in trouble. Black coffee, I see double. Ooh, ooh, ooh. How am I gonna get home? Black coffee, I'm so dizzy. Black coffee, please get busy. Ooh, ooh, ooh. Help me so I can get home. Had a little too much hoopy soup. All I meant to take was one. Now my head is going loopy-loop. Some stuffy kid, what fun, oh, black coffee, help a fella, black coffee, what'll I tell her, ooh, 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 I'm afraid to go home.
We're back with our conversation about espresso with Aaron Meister and Aaron McCarthy, and we're inviting your calls at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WMIC.org. or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Meister, didn't you travel to Italy on an espresso tasting tour?
I sure did. I took a little bit of a pilgrimage there a few years ago to see how espresso culture varied region to region. And I learned that espresso in Italy is sort of like barbecue in the United States, which is that every region has its style, and every region thinks their style's best.
Do Italians drink exclusively espresso-based drinks?
Well, there isn't any real brewed coffee, like filter coffee, as we would know it in the States. So it's mostly espresso in the coffee bars and espresso-based drinks. And then most people make stovetop, what's often called mocha pot, coffee at home, which is kind of like a variation somewhere between percolator coffee and espresso. It's like a very strong, little concentrated percolator coffee.
It's my sense that Americans are more obsessed by perfection when it comes to espresso than the Italians are. Do you think that that's true, Aaron? Well, either of you can answer. You both seem to know everything. And you both work together at different points in your careers, so you probably have discussed these things.
It's true. We basically finished each other's sentences, I think.
My first thought was that I think that we maybe have different ideas of what of perfection, you know. Definitely I've had a lot of Italians come and get a shot from me and not be pleased because I'm not, you know, maybe pulling it in the way in the style that they would want it. I do think that there's been a culture of geekery in the U.S. That has really kind of pushed espresso preparation and kind of thinking about it as a food. Like I said before, you know, it is a plant. It comes from, you know, a fruit.
So it's come a long way from when they used to put a lemon peel on the edge of the cup?
Absolutely, yeah.
Italians just hated that.
They hated the lemon?
They thought that was a very American thing.
Ah, yeah.
Well, it's really interesting, going back to the question from the fellow who called in, too, you know, this notion of the change in the profile of the coffees that we use for espresso. It's funny that espresso is one of those things that has come so far from its original iteration and its original place in a particular culinary culture, but it also retains so much of that tradition around it. Like, people have a very distinct idea of what, quote-unquote, espresso should taste like. And a lot of people will say, but in Italy they do it like this, or in Italy the coffee tastes like this. And so there's a lot of people in the States who still say espresso has to have Robusta in it, has to have a big head of crema, has to have a lot of chocolate and nuts and smoky flavors. And meanwhile, if you think about it, we don't assign those kinds of traditions to any other coffee brewing method. We don't say, oh, you know, we can only make French roasted coffee in a French press. Or, you know, the paper filter was invented in Germany in the 1900s. No one ever says that you have to brew paper filter coffee to taste the way it did in Germany, you know. And it's funny to me how much tradition is still assigned to espresso and the flavors that are achieved and that sort of the experience that people expect to have. Speaking to Aaron's, you know, experience where we'll have Italian customers that come in and they're in a coffee shop in the United States and they are disappointed by the coffee. But I, you know, I wouldn't necessarily go to Italy and go to an American style restaurant and be disappointed. You know, it's a very strange way that we've compartmentalized espresso as a food, even while still adapting it to meet our own cultural and societal needs.
You can find espresso machines at many appliance stores these days.
Sure, yeah.
And they're very expensive. Why are they so expensive?
I think one of the reasons is the boilers would be the most expensive part, and some espresso machines have one, some have two. From what I know, the mold that you have to make is kind of proprietary, and that is the machine that makes that mold is a kind of expensive to do. So that's definitely prohibitive.
If I have one of those machines, what, and then I want to go buy some coffee, what beans would I buy? Could you just smell a bean and know that it would make a good espresso?
I think that it depends on, I love the it depends on thing, right? We do that a lot. It depends on what you're looking for. What kind of espresso do you like? I will look at a bag of beans and say, when was it roasted? How much information is on the bag? Does the roaster put time and care into sourcing? And then maybe, yeah, I would open it up and look at it. If it's very oily, it looks like it's been around for a while, either the oil's coming to the surface of the bean mean that it's old or it's been roasted pretty dark. So I wouldn't maybe go that route. But in terms of taste, you know, something with a lot of fruit to it, a lot of maybe like citrus-like acidity might be right up my alley, but you might be going for something more, you know, chocolatey, or not to judge you, Leonard, not being old
both
school.
Both sound good to me, actually.
Yeah. So yeah, I would say that I am interested in flavor profiles of coffees, and so I would try them all. Yeah.
And Meister, must it be given the finest grind?
Quite the finest grind, but the grind size definitely dictates the way that your coffee is extracted. So if you think about what you're trying to do is pull the most material or pull a certain amount of flavor material out of the coffee beans, the finer you grind them, the more access the water has to that material that it's trying to pull out. So the key to making a great espresso is really to try and adjust your grind size to restrict or to encourage the extraction of that coffee flavoring material. So if you grind finer, more stuff can get pulled out by the water. But you might, you know, if you go too fine, then you extract some material that doesn't taste great, and that can contribute to the cup. So it's a little bit of a a fine line, I guess, you have to sort of play when you're dialing in your espresso.
And Aaron, why do you need to tamp down on the coffee?
That's a great question. Why do you need to? We're actually
you do. And
yeah, we're well. Kind of traditional way of thinking and why we do it is to give the puck more resistance against the water. And again, when you're thinking about espresso, you're thinking about a recipe, your grind size is important. Also, how long it brews is important, right? So you want to keep it, let's say you're keeping it between 20 and 30 seconds. The tamp helps it to resist more, or else the water would just push through. It's interesting though, because I work for Counterculture Coffee. At the end of the month, we're doing every 3 months we do a professional development series, and this one coming up at the end of the month is Mythbuster. So we're doing espresso myths and kind of trying to figure out, you know, from a professional point of view, whether these things, these kind of pocket science things that we've held on to, are actually true or not. And one of the things we're going to discuss is, do we actually need to tamp?
You know? What are some of the other myths? Or potential
Does an espresso die on the bar? You might have heard a barista yelling, you know, I have an espresso here dying on the bar. You know, it's losing its crema. It's losing all of its volatile flavor, aromatics. We're going to test that out too and see, you know, is that actually the case? A big one that I'm interested in is how much crema actually matters to the shot. With the invention of the lever machine that Gaggia invented in the 40s, it uses a spring to push the water through the pressure. That's when we got actually espresso crema. And it's been kind of like a cult of crema. And we're going to talk about whether that actually, you know, really adds to the taste or not.
And a listener, Tom from Dumbo, asks if there is any way to achieve a crema top when using a stovetop espresso pot that is the one made by Bialetti.
Yeah, you know, calling that espresso is actually a little bit of a misnomer, unfortunately, because the total dissolved solid, the TDS of espresso is actually a lot higher than what that stovetop pot can get. You can definitely get foam, but it doesn't have the pressure to be able to force the gas out.
Bob from Morristown, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air. Or is it Rob?
Yeah, hey.
I'm sorry, Rob.
No worries. Hey, so when I worked as a barista, I was really concerned about the quality of the espresso that I was putting out. So I'd often ask, you know, for honest feedback from customers. But now that I'm just a consumer, you know, I get some decently disappointing espresso. So I just wonder if there's a good way to give feedback about the espresso without sounding like a jerk.
Oh, gosh, that's such a good question. I have wrestled with this for my, like, whole professional life. I think that if you have a rapport with your barista, like if you have an interaction with them over the counter and it seems like they are really sort of willing to accept a little bit of feedback, especially if you're asking, if the espresso is so beyond the expectation that you had that you would like them to try and make it again, I think that you can sort of approach that on a case-by-case basis, maybe, because I do think that there are some probably baristas who wouldn't take it constructively, I suppose. One thing that would be really helpful is to have a little bit of vocabulary to be able to describe what's wrong with the espresso. For instance, if you're tasting a very, very sour note in your coffee, it might be a little bit under extracted, and you might be able to say to the barista, oh, I wonder if you could make this for me and just pull it a little bit longer. And if the coffee was tasting very, very bitter, it might be a little bit over extracted. So knowing a little bit of, you know, being able to sort of say, oh, this just isn't to my preference, could you maybe a different way?
Aaron, you won the 2013 World Brewers Cup. Weren't you the first American to win that competition?
I was, yeah.
What country usually takes home the prize? Italy?
Actually, no. Australia took it twice. Japan took it the year right after me.
And what did you have to do to win it?
Well, it's started out in the regionals, went to the U.S., and then winning the U.S. brought me there. It's a coffee brewing filter competition, so you can choose any method of pour over that you want. And the first round, everybody gets the same coffee, and you have 7 minutes to brew 3 cups. The judges don't know who you are. They're tasting it. They're judging it on a score sheet, and the top 6 get into the finals, and then you do a presentation. You bring your own coffee.
Just one more thing, Meister. Do you think that Starbucks has changed the way Americans view espresso, understand espresso?
Absolutely. I think that without Starbucks, most Americans wouldn't probably know what espresso was. So I think that Starbucks has done a huge, huge benefit to the, you know, the coffee drinking world, and certainly those of us who love making espresso. For making it so mainstream and making it so accessible and approachable, for sure. And it's opened, I think, a lot of people's minds to trying other kinds of espresso-based drinks, trying other coffee shops, being a little bit more adventuresome because they have this understanding of the Starbucks.
Aaron Meister and also Aaron McCarthy, thank you both so much for being on today's Please Explain Look at Espresso.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.